I'm Lieutenant Colonel Michael Gordon. I'm commanding officer of the 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Regiment. We're currently an air assault battalion within 16 Air Assault Brigade, undergoing the process of re-rolling to become the first light mech infantry battalion in the new Army 2020 orbit. I am an Army officer, which means that I speak probably the most user-unfriendly language within the English lexicon. I'm also a wargamer, which exacerbates the whole problem. So I will try not to use acronyms. If I do use any that you don't understand and I've missed a step, then please just stop me and ask what that means. Okay. I've just pressed the wrong button, which also proves that Army officers are not particularly IT literate. Right. The first caveat that I have is that I am not speaking as an official mouthpiece here. I'm not speaking for the Army. I'm speaking from a commanding officer's perspective. So this is my take on it. I'm passionate about wargaming, both as a practitioner and an advocate, and I believe there is a lot of utility within it. So what I'm going to be talking about now is my own subjective perspective on the whole thing. It's not the Army viewpoint, but a lot has changed since this time last year, where I was excruciatingly embarrassed by the lack of UK defence representation. Now, we had more Army officers from Holland, France, at least Germany, and even the United States than we did British Army officers. That's an embarrassment and something that we took away. It was spoken about earlier that we held the Army Symposium on the 9th of May. We ran that as a team effort and it was very well received. So there's a little bit of a head of steam being built up now, with General Skeets starting to pick it up from Sandhurst, and I believe he's tasked three brigadiers, to try and lead with this. Now, the fact that there are still so few British Army officers in here is still a cause for concern, but we are making progress. It's baby steps at the moment, but hopefully we'll maintain the momentum. This is what I'm going to talk about. Some of the slides will repeat. It's just as a reminder as I go through it. The biggest danger for me is I suspect General Andrew's going to throw something at me, because I could talk about this for hours and I've only got 25 minutes. I'm not going to talk about all the problems with military thinking. I'm going to just touch on what I think is the biggest problem that we still face, and that's credibility. So your average Army officer thinks if you talk about it too much in the mess that you're a beard, you're a boring bastard. And they think that it equates to something like this: either childish things, or the realms of the fantasy world, or, you know, overgrown children playing with toy soldiers. So we've got to overcome that. And again, we're doing it slowly, little by little, baby steps. So I interrogate my officer cadets when they pass out of Sandhurst and they come to me as new young officers. And this is the collective view that all of them have had when I introduce them to wargaming and start teaching them and mentoring them in the process and ask them about Sandhurst. They view the academic war study side as not being taken very seriously by the officer cadets, and that would be partly because the staff probably don't take it particularly seriously. And that is a problem, because this is learning about our trade. History is critical within the trade of the military. You know, you can take the thing too seriously, but ultimately, there is no other career out there. Even a surgeon, if he gets things wrong, there's a single person who will suffer the consequences of that. In the military environment, on operations, if you get things wrong, a lot of lives are potentially at stake. So it is something that we have to take seriously, but at the same time, you can have a bit of fun while you're doing it, and wargaming can introduce that. The other is that question two, within the seven questions, is largely glossed over. Now, that is particularly worrying, because you will have seen there that question two is about what I've been asked to do and why. And we say within our doctrine, within all the estimate process, the most important part is within mission command is understanding your commander's intent. So glossing over question two, which is where you really understand your mission and what your commander's intent is done at your peril. And then, of course, discussing military history, I said it there earlier, you're likely to be labelled a beard. But that's quite pertinent. I started wargaming early in my life. By the time I entered RMS, I realised I was no stranger to military tactics. So, commander of the 7th Brigade, Desert Rats, during the First Gulf War. And he came into that whole process as well, having been a wargamer, and he realised at Sandhurst that he had an innate understanding of the military decision-making process. Because if you're a passionate wargamer, whether you've gone through a formal process of understanding a 7 questions estimate or not, you do it. You do some sort of element of that within your wargaming approach. These are a couple of quotes. You've all seen the top one. I find the second one from Lieutenant Chamberlain quite insightful, because I've seen this happen as well. You try and engage a conversation in a mess on military history and people's eyes glaze over, but you put a map out and you start moving things around and Army officers want to get involved because they all know better than the other bloke. And they all want to get into an argument over it. And it's great because they become immersed. And that is the fundamental difference to me between putting a map and counters on a table with a bunch of army officers or sticking them in front of a computer where one bloke gets immersed in a screen and everybody else switches off. It's immersive. It gets them involved, it gets them engaged, and they want to start having a punch-up over who's going to do what to whom. My own personal experience, I started wargaming at about the age of 13. That was the squad leader back in those days. Not particularly well, I was too busy playing sport and all the other things, but I had a fascination for military history. At about that age, I'd identified I wanted to be an army officer. I've served in two armies now, in the South African Defence Force as an infantry platoon commander in the 1980s when we were a less than popular country, and more recently since 96 in the British Army. What I found, serving both of those armies, is the wargaming experience I had meant that I just had innately a better understanding of the application of tactics. And by the time I got to Sandhurst, the estimate process was not a problem for me, whereas actually for a lot of cadets, it is a big problem. And you spend time, if you understand the process, helping to mentor and lecture them through it so they can pass things like Pratt-Tac Hill. So it does, you know, it does help. It makes a big difference. So the corollary is if being a wargamer makes it easier for you in the in understanding the your trade and understanding the estimate process, then surely it should be a good tool to teach that process to young army officers as they're going through. Now, throughout my time in the British Army, all of those bits that you see there in red, that's going chronologically through my career, are areas where we should have wargamed, we could have wargamed, but we didn't. So we missed opportunities. So it should start at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst when you're an officer cadet, so that by the time you leave, you're familiar with your key tool, which is the seven questions. But they're not. The only time they're exposed to it is when they're being graded, DS, if you like, by the directing staff, and they're going to be marked on it. So there's a lot of pressure associated with it. And it comes up once or twice during the course of the year, and then it's forgotten about until you start doing it again on further courses, such as anti-tank platoon commanders courses or command and staff trainers. All of these things, you're being marked. So there's no fun element in it. It's all high pressure. Joint Command and Staff College, Company Command, these are all areas where I heard about wargaming. They talked about it on some of the courses, but you never actually saw it being used or exercised. That's changed. They're starting to introduce it in things like the Captain's Warfare course now. But the first time I started to use it properly was as a company commander, using advanced squad leader to train my subalterns in the estimate process. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. The first time I really sort of saw wargaming being done was as a senior major on advanced command and staff course. That, to me, is almost criminal, that all of that opportunity had been missed. And the first time I was exposed to it was as a major. Then as a battalion second in command with the Royal Irish, I used it. Doing capability development for the Ministry of Defence, I used it, and I've seen DSTL use it, and I've seen them improve the way that they deliver it to the Army as well, as part of capability and force development. And as a commanding officer now, I use it. But none of it's within the system. Okay, so that most of the areas that I've used it personally have again been entirely off my own bat. And that's a problem, because I'm going to be gone as a commanding officer in about 8 months' time. If the next bloke after me is not interested in wargaming, then all that work I've done over the last 2.5 years falls by the way. It's got to be part of the system. Tute versus wargame and co-wargaming, they've been talked about. I'll touch on those now in a minute. So, British Army wargaming, you've seen the way we do it, course of action wargaming. I'm an advocate of traditional gaming. I'm an advocate of putting a board down or a map down and having counters and moving them around and having a rule system that bounds the parameters, or tabletopping. They both have their utility. So how does that compare to TUTES, tactical exercises without troops? Tactical exercises without troops are very good training tools, but you have no adversary. So what you do is you sit down and you plan. They use these to teach the planning process to army officers. You sit down, you make a plan, you go out on the ground, you talk about it amongst your peers and with the directing staff, you pick up one or two points, then you all pat yourselves on the back because you never lose a tute, you always win, and you go home, job well done. So we're not exposed to failure, we're not exposed to your plan starting to fall apart. Versus CPXs, these are command post exercises which you run at unit level to train your battle group headquarters staff. And again, you have no adversary. So actually what I found is, as a battalion 2IC, I did a lot of planning with my staff, so that they became very proficient at it. But the first time we did a cast, an exercise where we were being tested to do the execute, we started to unravel a little bit because we had no practice at the execute. And that's when things start moving quite quickly. And you have to respond, you have to make decisions under pressure. versus course of action wargaming. Course of action wargaming is an outstanding tool as part of our planning process, but it is not adversarial. It is confirmatory. It's to make sure that you're looking for any holes in your plan and you can try and address those. Your intelligence officer, who normally plays the enemy, should not be playing to win by the time you do the wargame, because if he is, then he hasn't done his job properly, advising you on what the enemy are likely to do throughout the planning process. So it's not adversarial. And versus IT gaming, so much of what we do in the Army now is based upon a computer screen. What does that mean? Multi-million contracts, software experts, the requirement to have to plug in wherever you go, and it's not immersive. One bloke gets sucked into a screen and everybody else starts switching off. So I'm not a big fan of this. Although we do have to use, we have to get with the modern world, if you like. So there is a utility in it, but actually, with traditional board wargaming, you can still do the stuff that you have to do on the combat terminals using the IT systems. So that's a quick sum up, if you like, of how I see traditional wargaming, board wargaming, lined up against all the things that we do in the British Army. So where do I think we should, and how should we use wargames? The military decision-making process, MDMP, and conceptual development. Conceptual development, you heard General Andrews say, we as the Army officers are the conceptual component within our units. We have to take ownership of it. This is critical mass. It should be one of the most important things we do, is develop our subordinates and bring them on. I use advanced squad leader for that. I know Tom said yesterday, he looked at advanced squad leader and he said, I wouldn't advocate using that because it is a complicated system, but there are ways that you can work around the complexity, and I'll talk about that. So I'm going to give you some examples here now. I use advanced squad leader because I grew up playing squad leader and then advanced squad leader. I think it's a great game system. Of course, like any game, it has its flaws. There is no perfect system out there. But it's about how you use the systems and how you apply it. There's an advanced squad leader board. The hexes are 40 to 50 meters. So, and you play at the squad level. It's down at the section level. It's easy to understand. Individual weapon systems, individual leaders, squads and half squads. So instinctively, my soldiers, my subalterns understand what they're looking at. There's a map, you know, they understand the terrain and they can read it. And then what I did to introduce them to it was instead of teaching them the rules, we were on a live field firing exercise. I had a bit of time on my hands. I took my regiment signals officer and I took my ops officer. They had a bit of time and I brought them in and I gave them a problem, which was a probing attack by an American company against German, primarily second line troops in Aachen towards the end of the war. And I said, right, you go away, make a plan, do a 7 questions estimate, apply the principles of war as we use them in the British Army, and then you will fight against each other. Don't worry, I'll talk you through the rules as we go along. And they did. They came up with a plan, they fought against each other, they made a few mistakes, we did some recocks, but actually they stopped picking up the rules because they're playing through. And if you apply military logic to the problem, it works. You don't have to have a fundamental deep understanding of the rules to start with. In fact, I would argue that if you understand the rules too much, when you start playing, you're playing a set of rules and a game system instead of playing infantry tactics. So I think that was more effective. And now they've gradually started to learn the rules across my officer's mess, and they've become very enthusiastic about it. This is some of what they produced. Not me, I had nothing to do with this. And it closely resembles the sort of product we produce on combat terminals when you're doing battle group headquarters planning. So, you know, they did their terrain analysis, and I'm only going to show you a couple of slides here, not all of them. They identified where key vital ground and key terrain was, avenues of approach, a full IPB, intelligence preparation of the battlefield, if you like. They came up with various key deductions, so this comes from the mission analysis, and then they came up with their plans. And I'm going to hold on to that one for a little bit, because actually that is a COA schematic. That is an intent in a COA schematic. And at the Wargaming Symposium we did on the 9th of May, SO1 Cast North, so the guy who runs the command and staff trainer up in Catterick was in the audience. He came to me afterwards and he said, the product that the subalterns were producing here is better than what he's getting from some battle group headquarters on cars. And I found that to be quite telling. I mean, that was vindicating for me because it means that they understand the process, they understand their tools and they understand their doctrine. And they've got a head start on when they do things like the captain's warfare course. They're familiar with the tools of their trade and they're comfortable with it. I'll use another little anecdote. I use advanced squad leader now to prepare my officers when they go off and do the captain's warfare course. My regimental administrative officer, who's a female AGC, or adjutant general corps officer, not an infantry officer, no infantry trade, went off to do the captain's warfare course. And we prepared her by running her through advanced squad leader. And within her syndicate, She did better than many of the infantry officers, some of whom failed. Now, infantry officers are fantastic at cuffing. We're very good in an infantry environment of getting up in front of an audience and being all full of confidence and bluster and the rest of it, and getting away with murder or not having a detailed plan because we talk with confidence. And that's where some of the infantry officers fell apart here. What she did is she sat down and she did the detail, she applied the tools, and she achieved results because of it. If you're looking for other evidence, if you like, when I was a company commander, I trained my subalterns as well using advanced squad leader. What they used to go then was go off and do a course called JOTAP. I can't remember what those acronyms stand for, forgive me. But two of those three officers came top of their JOTAP courses on the estimate. And I'm not saying that was down to me, but both of them came back and said they felt that they had a head start because they had a better understanding through having applied the tools of the trade in an adversarial manner through traditional board war game. So what everybody likes, as General Andrew said at the War Games Symposium, everybody likes to know what happened. Well, I'll give you a little synopsis here of the battle that they fought. So this was an American company attacking into Aachen. They had to try and seize the 25 buildings. Not necessarily a realistic military objective, but you kind of get the intent behind it, which was to deny the Germans the crossroads in Aachen, if you like. So their plan of attack was to, and there was about 200 metres of no man's land. So there was a bit of an advance to contact that had to be done. Forming up positions and final assault positions and the rest of it had to be identified. The Americans advanced. What they wanted to do was to break in the middle, which they identified as being their sort of vital ground and vital to the German defence. They wanted to do a break in the middle with a bit of a threat on the flanks, but having an opportunity to exploit. So those were the Allied initial actions. They advanced across the ground, seized buildings that they could then have as their final assault position. Things started to go wrong from the start. One example, the first time the guys played through it, is moving two sections with one of their critical weapons systems from this area here, which was their line of departure, across this uncleared ground into a position where they could use their main weapon system. So they moved, they played a game system. They moved two sections and a machine gun with a leader across uncleared ground. They were the first people to move, and they drew fire, and he lost a section and a half of troops and a leader and a medium machine gun left out in the open. We re-cocked straight away, because I said to him, and initially the first reaction was, oh, the game's rubbish, look at that, look what's that, that wouldn't happen. I said, okay, in reality, would you take your critical weapon system and move it across uncleared ground before you did any, what would you do? Pause for thought, okay, I would do a recce first. So we re-cocked, and what they did is they sent out infantry recce probes to clear the ground so they could then bring up the bulk of their force and their key weapon system. Simple lesson learned to the application of a game. And the lesson was learned as well that we're not playing a game system here, we're playing proper infantry tactics. Do them right, doesn't matter what the dice outcomes are, against somebody who's doing poor infantry tactics, and you still have a fairly good odds of winning. The Allied break-in started to become fixed in the middle. Actually, they achieved success on the southern flank down in this area here, but by that stage, that blue arrow there, because he was becoming fixed there, not achieving the results he wanted, he started to reinforce failure, not success. So the Allies started to become unstuck here. The Germans achieved their aim, they fixed them. They fixed them in the centre here, which was their main defensive position. There was also success on the northern flank there, but there was a lot of open ground to cross, so it turned into a bit of a slugging match. Over here was the opportunity to exploit and get around the German flank and to turn their flank effectively. So the Allied attack became fixed in the centre, insufficient force to exploit in the south. And some of the lessons, now these are the lessons this was not me prompting, this is the officers themselves drawing the lessons up, which were things like the importance of depth and mutual support within the Germans. So, you know, they had positions here of mutual support. As this assault came through, though, it was insufficient to stop the Allies from gaining a toehold here. Failure to exploit, one of the critical ones, because the Allies reinforced the centre where they were not achieving success and didn't exploit the success that they had in the south. An effective use of reserves, which the Germans did very well. So they saw things starting to unhinge over here. They pushed troops off to their southern flank to try and block that because they realised it wasn't very strong. And what they kept on doing here was recycling troops who were breaking, rallying them in depth, and then pushing them back in, operating on interior lines. So the lesson of effective use of reserves sank in as well. Those were the key points that the subalterns themselves took away from a simple scenario in a traditional board war game. So it's good for professional development. Those are some of my officers sitting and planning and briefing It's good for young officers' confidence as well, because they get up in front of the entire mess as a subaltern, second lieutenant, fresh out of Sandhurst, briefing on their plan, and then executing it. And this is some of the product that they were producing. I also use it for battlefield studies. Two battlefield studies. One is Battalion Second in Command. I used a very shoddy old game, but it's quite effective, at Monte Cassino, which is down at the company level, quite effective tool. And we used the wargaming map when we went out there, and it enhanced the experience for people once they were actually on the ground. And most recently, as a CEO, I went out to Leros last year, and again, we used the gamers' map. You can see it up there. It's a complicated game system, though. It's a difficult one. But we used the map. We planned both the German and the Allied perspectives. We compared it to what they did in reality. And my view is that people took a lot more from that battlefield study than they would have if we'd gone there and been briefed at by a historian. I'm not knocking historians here, but if you do that and it's not interactive, then people again start to switch off. And that was, you can't see the pictures, very dark, but that was my battle group headquarters staff sitting in the hotel in Leros with the map out and moving counters across it as we discussed what happened in the battle. Staff development, have a look at that. I'm not going to talk about each one of those, but the game out there, A Distant Plane, I think gives fantastic insights into Afghanistan. And it's good for staff development and staff understanding. What we've done over the last 10 years going into Afghanistan is been deluged on IT with reading material. Must read stuff before you go out to Afghanistan. And you don't have the time for it for a start, and it doesn't give you the understanding. This simple game, well, it's not a simple game system, but this game system here, I think, gives more insights into what's going on out in Afghanistan and all the reading material that we used to be given before the war. It gives you all of that. You know, it gives you some sort of sense of what comes in a simple package box. Capability and force development. Sebastian, I haven't met you yet. I found this on a website. Fantastic looking game system, not least of which because one of the operations in there is one that I served on, and I look forward to that being released. And that is something I would buy for my mess, because I think that what I see of it so far gives a fantastic insight and an opportunity to fight in a modern urban environment. And this is a hypothetical North German plane set in the 1980s with more modern equipment. You know, the games are out there that can be used for this sort of capability and force development. It does tie in with it. Ultimately, though, what it must come down to for me is competitive fun. I want my officers to play this, not feeling like they're being marked. I want them to lose, because I think it's good to lose. We don't lose when we do tutes. We don't lose when we do CPXs. It's good to lose. It's good for your plan to start unraveling and have to execute decisions under pressure. And that's what they do, but they do it in a fun environment. And the best part for me is when I've been doing the wargaming piece and I hand it over to them and they start fighting the battles, is when they forget that the commanding officer is in the room and they become so immersed in the game and fighting each other that, you know, my presence is an irrelevance. And that is some of my officers huddled over the game, starting to indulge in a punch-up. The other thing that I do is I make sure that this is done in working hours, because this is part of developing them. So if you start making it encroaching to their own private time, then they'll start resenting it. So this is part of conceptual development, which means we do it as part of the working day. So I'll give an afternoon off for subalterns to come up with a plan, and another afternoon then when I'll get together, give a quick brief and fight it out in front of the rest of the officers in the mess. And I think that's important as well, because you start taking the fun element out if it starts becoming their own time. Now, one of my officers, I've got a company out in the Falklands at the moment, one of them has become so immersed in it, the company second in command, he went out and bought advanced squad leader starter kit so that they could take it out to the Falklands as well. Now, you know, that's the beauty and the nature of the condition of the box is reflective of how much it's being used. But something that size, which you can stick in your Bergen and take away with you anywhere on exercise, you don't need computers to plug in, you don't need software experts to help you run it, that's it, it's in a box, all you need. And they're doing it out in the Falklands when they have the time. What I've just talked about, I wish I could say was all my own idea. Marcus talked about in fact some of you in the wargaming community would have heard of Steve Detlefsen. There's an article in this magazine by Lieutenant Steve Detlefsen when he was a US Marine Corps engineer officer about how he used advanced squad leader. He got sent the module out while they were waiting to invade Kuwait. Interestingly, you know, I've worked with the Americans. British soldiers, British Tommies out in the desert get sent Razzle and Reader's wives. Our American colleagues get sent, apart from gun and car magazines, war games modules. So you know, that says something perhaps about their approach to it. But that's where I got the idea from. And I'll have this and a few other articles at my stand today if anybody wants to flip through them. Okay, so what's the way ahead? Early beginnings, we've got to start with officer cadets at Sandhurst. What we need is something that is simple, and you've heard Mark Neely already say at Sandhurst, they're starting to use a very simple system. It's got to be adaptable, and it's got to be standardized. It needs to be something that we can roll out across the Army. So you take it from Sandhurst all the way through. It needs to be scalable, so you can do it down at the platoon level, but something that you can also escalate up to the brigade and the divisional level. It needs to be immersive. It needs to involve as many people as possible instead of one man in front of a screen. It needs to be cost effective, and you know that costs 20 quid. Every unit should have something like that. 20 quid on your shelf in the mess, and we do one a month. We do one scenario a month. Every subby in the battalion will go through one a month, which means they're doing 9 probably more estimates a year than they would have been doing otherwise. And we've got to own it in the military. Sorry for all of those of you out there involved in the industry, but we cannot be tied into industry contracts here who are ultimately looking to make profit. This needs to be something we own in the military. That's my view again. As I said, this is subjective. Because that keeps it more cost effective. So there are a lot of opportunities out there, commercial off the shelf. I'm going to touch on them briefly. You've seen how I use Advanced Squad Leader. There's another game system I'm quite interested in using. It's Panzer Grenadier, because I quite like the command and control that's associated with it. It cascades down, so a colonel can activate majors, you can activate captains, etc., etc. And I think any good game system should be simple, but it should also try and capture command and control issues and logistic issues. And I think this game does it reasonably well. World at War, you know, if you want to become more modern and look at some hypothetical, this is from Lock and Load. I've not played this, but I've looked at it. I know it's a bucket of dice game, which would have some issues with the military fraternity, but it has modern kit, and they like that. So it's probably somewhere in between. Campaign plan. You can use it for campaign planning. I quite like the monster games. I've played Pacific War. I've done a full estimate on the Guadalcanal campaign, and I'll put that out again here as an example about how I've used the 7 questions for a land-sea-air operation in Guadalcanal. And you can do campaign planning, and you can do it up at the higher levels where you're involving air command, navy command, and, of course, the land. And this is not just a land sport. I use Burma here as an example because it's a very good operational level game. You've got real command and control issues here and particularly real logistic issues. And you look over there, there's a mule train up in the jungle. You know, it goes down to that sort of level of logistics. And I think these are the best kinds of games for me, from my perspective. Understanding the environment, you've seen that slide already. So what? Well, you know, you put that out and you get your staff officers around there and you get them to start understanding Afghanistan by playing the 4 different factions, the key factions that are out there. Labyrinth is another one, you know, the global war on terror. One of my company commanders at the moment has borrowed that from me. He's been sitting with it for 2 months now and is using it with some of his blokes, and it's giving them insights into some of the factors out there, some of the soft factors, if you like, associated with the global war on terror. There are hypothetical and modern scenarios out there. They may not all be good simulations, but you know that one there, Somali pirates, for example, you look at that, and again, it considers some of the modern issues, some of the soft factors that the earlier World War II type war games don't cover. That game, I think, was produced a couple of years ago, a hypothetical scenario of Russians in the Ukraine. Yeah. So the hypothetical can become the real. And I've talked about battlefield studies as well. You know, my guys out in the Falklands at the moment have also been using the decision games in one of their magazine games of the Falklands. You know, we're in the commemoration of World War I, and there's a lot of World War I games out there. I'm going to be using that, and Dave Schroeder is in the audience here who's designed this game. I think this is the best game system I've encountered with World War I. Really cements some of the lessons learned, but it's very complicated to use as a simple tool, but it's one that you can put out there and illustrate some of the command and control and supply and logistics problems and the importance of railways, for example, that pertain to the opening moves of World War I. So we will be using that in my mess. And capability and force development. My battalion at the moment, re-rolling, we are the first battalion that will be light mech. That is the work program that has been set up, that we're no longer light PM, that's been changed to mechanized. But this is the sort of work that I've been allocating to members of my staff and my company commanders. You'll see a lot of it there is the tactical. So offensive operations, advanced contact, obstacle crossings, that sort of thing. Now, we're wargaming these. We have built big sand models, so we're tabletop wargaming it to cement some of the SOPs and TT tactics techniques and procedures that we need to try and make this work, because this is new ground. There is no doctrine for it yet. And developing the doctrine as we go along. And this is the sort of product that comes out of it, you know. What vehicles you have, what your breakdown is, how they go into the vehicles, what sort of frontages you will have, how you use and utilize those on the ground, how you'll employ them. So this is all new stuff. And of course, I said earlier, you know, we don't want to leave the naval and the air out of this. In fact, I think for a long time the naval aspect was leading wargaming back in the 19th century. You know, there's a lot to be. You know, Harpoon, I think, is one of the big systems out there at the moment. And there's a lot of air gaming out there to be done as well. So. And then you can bring the three together, and we must bring the three together if we're going to succeed in this whole wargaming thing. Ultimately, again, it comes down to competitive fun. Make it enjoyable, and the enthusiasm will catch on. And it's not the older generation that need to be driving. This shouldn't be top-down. This should be top-down led and top-down directed, but the enthusiasm has got to be generated with the young subalterns coming through so that it carries on. So there's a legacy there that carries forward, as opposed to you know, those of us who are at the more advanced element of our career, we're going to be moving on shortly, who may be enthusiastic about it, then leaving a vacuum when they move on. It's got to be inculcated as a culture within the younger guys coming through and moving on. And there's a role for everybody within that, you know, whether it's commercial stuff off the shelf, which caters to the military market, but ultimately within the military itself, to design, develop, and take forward the whole process and understand the utility and the importance of it.